is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll start out the conversation with Ken Davidson. He's the publisher of the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog. He has gone further than just being a citizen journalist, as he calls himself. He has gone ahead and filed a complaint in court concerning how two boards here in Northwest Indiana operate, in particular, whether they're reacting to or responding to the public on some of the issues that come up. We'll find out more about that. We have another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University for you today. And a little later, we'll get the latest concerning the problems that Lakeshore PBS has been having with their transmitter. We should hear to find out the update on getting a different and a new transmitter on the air soon for public television viewers. This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte, and with me in studio is Ken Davidson, who's the creator and publisher of the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog. He's known for keeping a close eye on what governmental agencies do in Northwest Indiana, along with many other people who are civic-minded people, to say the least, and certainly ones who want to be sure that the public know about what is going on. We'll find out more here about the complaint that he has filed in court, but the questions that have come up lately here deal with whether the public really knows as much as they should know. And this is up to the point now, of course, during the public comment period and now afterward, about the expansion that's planned on the South Shoreline. In particular, I guess we're talking about mostly the West Lake expansion, which is the line that is proposed that will come south from Hammond, come down to as far south as Dyer, and then of course the double tracking, which is also planned between Gary and Michigan City, is part of the route as well too. Ken, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, for folks that are not familiar necessarily with the blog, tell us how you got started with that and where you've got it up to now.
So about 5 years ago, I just started writing a little bit. I had some spare time. I was actually going through a medical crisis with my mother and taking her to a lot of doctor's appointments and things like that. And so I took my iPad and just started writing. And over the course of the 5 years, through lots of trials and tribulations and admitted mistakes and different things, we've grown to about 30,000 followers and published, I don't know how many, millions and millions of page views. So
it's probably difficult to name what a typical reader of the blog would be or would be like here, but what would you say that the typical person that checks into the blog to find out what you put in there is?
I don't collect any demographics on anyone that comes, you know, that's one of the things that I just don't do. I guess I should, and people that market these types of things. You know, I had somebody take a look recently, some great guys out of St. John took a look, and they said, well, you're not capturing any of this information that would be valuable. And I said, yeah, I just don't, not interested in that. I have so much other things on my plate, so many other things on my plate. I don't have time to deal with the marketing end of it. So,
what kind of reaction do you get from some of your blog readers about what you put out there?
Well, it's interesting because the reaction is always instant, and oftentimes it's either, you know, and that's why I say many mistakes. I mean, the people will keep you in line, basically. And if you're responsive to that, then you'll get to a point, I think, where there's an equilibrium and you are expressing the things that are important to people. Not necessarily that they want to hear, but that are important to people. And if you can, over time, one of the things that I've done in response to reader comments and things like that is, if you take a look at my articles, I try to have them contain at least as much data from original sources as they do my own words. And so incorporated within the articles, and then at the end of the article, I always try to include the source materials. I encourage people to read the source materials as much as possible.
And I know that in particular in some of the postings that you have had lately that kind of got my attention that I wanted to talk with you about here is the issue that is dealing with the expansion that's proposed on the South Shore Line and how the Regional Development Authority and the Transportation Board, actually the board that runs the South Shore Line, the NICTE board as people typically know it, have been reacting with the citizens about the project and keeping them informed about all the facets on there. And I know this now too, and you've brought this up, and what's ended up now in the paperwork that you filed in court is trying to get some kind of action or decision about the state law that has come about as a result of last legislative session that is making some changes in how the RDA board and how the NICTI board are run. And I guess the responsibilities that they turn over to their individual staffs to make sure that the agencies run properly. It seems very confusing, and maybe you could probably clear some of that up.
Yeah, I think it's intentionally confusing. And so year after year, the RDA board in particular has been given more and more power. And in the last legislative session, there was a broad bill, which is probably far beyond the scope of our 15-minute discussion, mm-hmm. that provided great authority to the RDA board. One of the things that is of particular concern to me is it said that as they proceed through these projects, no other Indiana code provisions apply. And so that, in my reading of that, and I could be wrong, would be conflict of interest, public meetings, public records, any kind of oversight would not apply to them as they proceed through this process of financing what is now $764 million. One of the largest projects, which, by the way, is going to lead to other very large projects, because we know right now they're saying the TOD is going to be another $700 million. The double tracking is going to be another $300 million. So we're getting pretty close to $2 billion in expenditures, the majority of which is going to come from local sources.
And this TOD that you referred to, is the abbreviation for transit-oriented development, which is, I guess, something that goes along with the expansion of the line itself. It's talking about economic development in the neighborhoods, I guess.
Absolutely. And so the theory is that in order to make this line successful, the ridership projections, the population projections that are being used to justify the expenditure of $764 million, you are required to provide, in order to make this line successful, you need to have dense mixed-use buildings around the station areas. Mm-hmm. And so there is a comprehensive strategic plan which outlines exactly how and where they're going to do that. And there was a bill, House Bill 1144 in, I believe, 2016, that provided that the RDA could create these transit development districts within a mile of the station area. The RDA then can take all the local revenue out of that, the increases in local revenue out of those station areas up until 2047. And they can use that to put back into the area for development of these dense mixed-use areas. That's really the part of it that I think people are not getting and don't understand at this point because they haven't gotten a lot of information on it.
In respect to these districts, do you get the impression that it's additional taxes or it's some of the taxes that perhaps residents or businesses may pay to the cities where they're located that will have to go back in?
It absolutely is. The transit development districts will work similar to how a tax increment financing works now, except that they will take all increments of property tax, local option income tax, state sales tax, and state income tax. So the two sources that our locals rely on primarily for funding, which are your local property taxes and your local option income tax, those are going to sort of dry up. They're not going to see any increases, let's say, over the next 30 years. But also we are, at this point, we're demolishing buildings at a record pace within those transit development districts.
Are we noticing any, I guess, questions that come out here that citizens have made? Did they make these kind of questions known during the public comment period when NICTI was asking citizens for their view as they were trying to explain what the projects were all about?
There's a group that has become somewhat vocal, and that is the Westlake Corridor residents, the NICTI Westlake Corridor residents. They're based in Hammond and Munster. I think people feel somewhat powerless. There was a Munster meeting that became very contentious. It was, you know, some of these meetings were very well attended. Having your comment that you oppose the project published in a report that goes to the federal government doesn't really seem like something that helps people a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's. I guess a better opportunity for citizens to make their certainly make their comments known to the boards themselves or the representatives of the boards. But you think that there should be more that should be made, at least the information should get to at least to Indianapolis, if not, if it doesn't get to Washington, D.C.?
Well, it's in the final environmental impact statement. Mm-hmm. You can see the comments in there about, according to the statistics that they published, about 10% of the comments were opposed to the project, about 15% were in favor of the project, and then they had different categories of comments, some of which I think if you analyze them, many of which show that the people making them are opposed. Also, the residents of the Westlake Corridor Residents Group published one letter, which then counted, even though there were hundreds of people that signed on to it, counted as one comment, which drove that 10% number down. Mm-hmm. But those comments are all published. They're available online on the final environmental impact statement. So, yes, they have gone to Washington. Whether they have any impact or not is, again, another question.
I guess the other question, because something you mentioned about the fact that the public has some input, they've had some input, but there apparently have been, I get the impression I get that there have been changes or at least reviews of things as the process is moving along. We're talking in particular about the fact that, of course, there has to be federal funding for the project. That's part and parcel of all of this, and it has to go on for approval in Washington. But this information gets back to the local boards, in this case, in particular, to the NICTI board, and I suppose even to the RDA board, since they are working with NICTI on the project for the financial end of it. If things don't get bad, if things are kept updated, if they keep updates to them as to what things are doing or what isn't being done, that they're knowing, okay, this paperwork is moving through at this particular pace, the public should know as much or should know more, if shouldn't.
That's correct. Absolutely. And so one of the things that is a major contention right now is not whether or not there's going to be federal funding. That's a contention too, but I accept that there most likely will be. I anticipate that there will be. But there is a real question as to whether or not that funding is going to come in at 20% or 50%. Now, in a $764 million project, that's over $100 million, over $200 million difference in federal funding. And my question is, what say are the residents going to have, and when will we know that money is going to come out of our pockets? And I mean, it all comes out of our pocket. Let's face it. It's federal money or local money. But, you know, they're going to need more of a local match if, in fact, it comes back federally financed at 20%. I don't think they're going to stop the project. I think they'll push it through, but, you know, find another way to fund it.
In your paperwork that you filed with the county circuit court, you talk, I guess, in particular, I guess, or making point that you wanted some kind of determination from a judge who's going to review this as to whether the boards involved, and we're talking, I guess, the RDA board and the NICTI board, are doing things as they should and following through and letting the public know, or at least certainly keeping the media aware, which they have, but to even more so about how things are coming along. That's the impression that you get just by looking at the complaint. Is that one of your intents?
Sure. And so let me first let's go back, and I do want to make one point with regard to public record requests. The public access counselor has chastised RDA for not being responsive to public record requests in the past. Numerous public record requests are pending, delayed. It's very difficult to get information from them. But I do want to, if we could, and I know we're limited on time, mm-hmm. read the two paragraphs. There's just two simple paragraphs that I think are in contention here. The is that all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
The state statute creates a board which is supposed to do certain things, and that board is appointed by the governor and our local elected officials. And so in Section 3 of NICTI Resolution 1801, which I have right on the Gazette if you want to take a look at it, it's also on the RDA website. So it's in in.gov/RDA, and it's right there on the front page. The board approves and authorizes the execution of the governance agreement attached hereto in substantially final form as Exhibit 8, which outlines the roles and responsibilities among and between the parties related to the financing, development, acquisition, construction, operation, and maintenance of the projects, including the financing plan established including the financing plan in the form of Exhibit 5 of the governance agreement, subject to the understanding that certain approvals with respect to the double-track project will need to be provided by the parties in the future before the double-track project is approved. The chair and or the chief executive officer are authorized to execute and deliver the governance agreement and financing agreements in such form, and here's where we get into the what I think is an issue here, with such changes, additions, and deletions to form and substance as they approve, but materially consistent with the intent of the form attached. So there's a contract, and what they're saying is, we'll sign this contract, and you just go ahead and change it however you want in the future. Yeah. Those contracts, I'm alleging at least, need to be signed in a public forum by the public bodies that are designated to sign those.
So I get the impression that the complaint that you filed is just basically asking for some judicial guidance and maybe not wrapping knuckles or anything like that, but at least mentioning that these judges saying that these things should happen and they should be done in the public purview and these should be brought up in more public viewing.
Absolutely. I would analogize it to some extent to challenges that have been made to President Trump's executive orders. We haven't seen much pushback from local leaders on this, and I'm surprised at that. But I know a couple days ago you had Spiros Batistatos on speaking about the convention center and sort of singing the praises of the RDA in relation to what they've done thus far on the convention center. But let's assume for a second that in 2020 we got a different governor who was opposed to the expenditure of public funds for a convention center. Now, we've already spent X amount of dollars moving forward, right? And we would get a new head of the RDA who could then, and let's assume that not one person in Lake County voted for this governor. Let's assume that every vote that this governor got came from Indianapolis and Fowler and Jeffersonville and Arias Evansville throughout the state, right? Not one person in Lake County voted for this governor. But that governor could appoint somebody who could completely nix our convention center, even though we've spent $1 million moving forward. That process doesn't seem to be the way local representative government works, right?
That's the question that comes up here, and we're going to have to bring this up for another conversation, I think, here, which I knew this would happen, but that's fine, too. Ken Davidson is the person who's created and runs the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog, and he's been addressing some of the questions that come up about whether the public has had enough the opportunity to talk about these projects, in particular the projects that we've kind of focused in so far on the South Shore Line. And Ken, thank you for spending some time with us and talking a little bit about the complaint that you filed in court, and we'll have you back to talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I took music lessons from a guy that lived in downtown Gary, so I had to get on the bus and go to downtown Gary. Gary from the steel mills till about 9th Avenue, almost 100% white. The downtown shopping area, which went from about 4th and Broadway till 9th Avenue, that was a mixed area, very commingled down there, no big deal. But when you pass the Little Calumet River, which was around 30th Avenue, it was almost 100% black. And my bus went down Grant Street, and it was a kind of a ghetto, if you want to call it that. It just looked rough to me. Yeah, I was anxious. I don't know why I was anxious. I guess everything just looked so distressed. It kind of scared me. I think that I honestly believed that there was just a cultural difference, that this is the way black people lived as opposed to the way white people lived. But I do have to tell you one story. I had taken the bus down to get my trumpet lesson. And apparently, when I was sitting in the bus, somehow my 15 cents to get home fell out of my pocket. Now, I could have asked my instructor for 15 cents, but about that time, I was getting a little bullheaded. So I walked home through the heart of the black neighborhood. I was scared to death. I don't think I thought the black people liked the white people. But you know what? Even though I was carrying a trumpet, something somebody could have clobbered me over the head and stole, nobody said a word to me. That walk convinced me that these people aren't evil or demons or out to pick on white people. They didn't even look at me funny. It was kind of like I just walked on home. And I think that kind of changed my view on how things were. Like, hey, it really would be okay to go down there. But I think I felt like maybe a little bit of me said, boy, you really dodged a bullet getting through that, you know, without getting beat up or something like that. But, you know, but on the other hand, I think it did change me a little bit. I think if I ever saw a black person walking through Glen Park, that I would go out of my way to make sure that person got safely past my neighborhood.
You can find out more local stories, regional stories, at Welcome Project. That's one word, welcomeproject.valpo.edu. On August 25th, there will be a 5K run and walk held in Munster, the proceeds from which will benefit the Autism Society in Northwest Indiana and the city's police department. Megan Mellis, with Orthopedic Specialist in Northwest Indiana, says that the event is being set up here, and in particular, named for a young autistic Munster resident, Chance Foster Juergens.
Chance was 12 years old, and he was a resident here in Munster. You know, we learned of his passing from the Northwest Indiana Times paper, and you know, we're just very devastated. And you know, he was autistic, very intelligent, sweet, fun-loving boy, and this will be our fourth annual 5K, and typically we use the local veterans organization as a benefactor, but we felt compelled, you know, to reach out to the family to see if there's something that we can do. You know, that was when we made the decision to donate our race to autism and work closely with his mother, who has just been thrilled that this is the case because it's given her something to focus on, mm-hmm. You know.
I guess when you talk about a young man like Chance, certainly didn't have all the great advantages, unfortunately, because he was autistic. What do you think that this will possibly spell, or at least say to other people, if they participate in the 5K run and walk? What would that do you think help do in the community to help expand the knowledge that people have about the problems that autism can bring to a person?
I think it'll serve two purposes. I think it will certainly raise awareness, you know, around autism, and I think that it will also show community support and camaraderie. You know, it'll really kind of hit home for that small town, a tight-knit community, you know, which shows support not only for, you know, this little boy that lost his life, but it will show support for his family in that he loved helping people. We thought that this race would really be able to kind of continue on Chance's quest to help people, because we are accepting monetary donations that will be donated to the Munster Police Department to help fund a brand new canine. And the canine is going to be used as a comfort dog for children with autism. Chance was very involved in the DARE program, so his mother knew that, you know, he would be elated to know that we were able to help the Munster Police Department out in finding, you know, in funding a new dog. And then the second part is we're doing a Lego drive, and we're asking participants to bring Legos that we can donate to local autistic foundations, charities for underprivileged, because, you know, Legos really kind of help stimulate their mind, and it's something that, you know, Chance was really into. And what I think it will do is I think it will just, you know, continue to show community outpour and, you know, community, you know, camaraderie and support. And then I think it will, you know, raise awareness for autism as well.
Now, if anybody is interested in participating in the 5K run walk in honor of Chance Foster Juergens, how can they find out where they can sign up to register for the event, as well as where they can go when it's time to run or walk?
Sure, absolutely. So the important part, too, is that this race is free. It's fully funded by Orthopedic Specialists of Northwest Indiana. So the surgeons do not charge anything for this. They do this to promote, you know, a healthy lifestyle and to get the community out and together. So it's a free race, but they can sign up on our Orthopedic Specialists of Northwest Indiana Facebook page, or they can sign up at osni.org. And there's a link right on our Facebook page that'll lead you to the sign up. And that's where you need to donate. Or you can, you know, certainly, you know, bring a check to the race at the time of the run, you know, as well as Legos, if that was something someone wanted to donate as well.
Well, Megan Mellis, thank you very much for the information. And fourth annual 5K run and walk in honor of Chance Foster Juergens, autistic young man who lost his life across from his home in May of this year. And it's nice to know that it's this opportunity for folks here in Northwest Indiana to show their support for programs like the Autism Society, as well as the Munster Police Department, which is going to get the benefit of have a new comfort dog that will be trained to work with autistic children. Thank you very much, Megan, for being with us. with us.
Thank you so much.
And if you have questions about the August 25th event, you can also email Megan at mmellis, M-E-L-L-I-S, that's one word, at osni.org. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Several Northwest Indiana organizations are working toward improving our local economy and enhancing the quality of place in the region by the creation of what is called a region-wide plan. And Northwest Indiana has had a chance to take a look at that plan. And Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson talked with Heather Ennis, the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, about its development and the plan's goals.
For those who don't know, can you tell us what the Northwest Indiana Forum is and what its purpose is?
Sure. So we are the voice of Northwest Indiana business and the 7-county economic development organization covering Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Jasper, Newton, Pulaski, and Stark counties. So it is our job to tell the story of Northwest Indiana, going out and promoting the region, attracting businesses to come here, acting as the voice of Northwest Indiana business from a public policy perspective, as well as bringing together parties and operating as a united front for developing a vision for the region and helping to work with partners across the region to really capitalize on the opportunities that we have here in the region. So
tell me about the Northwest Indiana Forum and the development of the Regional Economic Development Strategic Playbook.
Yeah, so it's been a while in the process. We've been working on this. Initially, we were kind of reorganizing the strategic plan of the forum, but then we realized economic development works with a broad base of partners and a broad base of opportunities to move all of these assets together and move the partnerships together more cohesively. So we have not had an economic development regional plan previously. We've got the 2040 plan and we've got the Marquette plan. We've got other plans that have great goals and aspirations, but not anything that cohesively works economic development all together and what that means and how we're all operating together. So we went through the process of bringing in an outside consultant to talk with us about this because, of course, it's nice to get some perspective on it. Sometimes we can't see the forest through the trees, and having an outside company come in and look helps us to really evaluate the opportunities that are right here in front of us. So we went through a pretty stringent vetting process to bring on TIP strategies, and we're extremely excited about them. They came very highly recommended from people all over the country, and they've been engaged in a wide variety of opportunities such as this. But mostly, the thing that we found, two points that we found very exciting about them is that they'd worked over large geographical areas that had varied interests and multiple jurisdictions, similarly to the makeup of Northwest Indiana. And then on the back end, they really produce a pragmatic playbook that helps give timelines and action items, and so it's an action-oriented plan. It's not something that is designed to sit on a shelf or you know, designed to be looked at or a coffee table book. This is actually an action-oriented, implementable plan. So we're very, very excited about that and the opportunity to use this plan to really make some dramatic improvements on the cohesiveness of the region as a whole.
And you say action, and the goal of the action is to what? Bring more businesses into Northwest Indiana to sell it? To
help grow the economy of Northwest Indiana, whether that's through working with partners to encourage a environment of entrepreneurship and innovation, whether it's attracting new business here, helping the business that's here to grow. You know, and again, this is not a plan for the forum, it's a plan for the region as a whole. So developing workforce and helping attract the workforce that fits in line with the talent that we need to make our companies that are here successful, as well as we diversify our economy and being able to attract the workers that are needed for a more diverse economy. So it is a playbook that we're working across many sectors and with many regional partners on, and talking about how we build upon the double tracking in the Westlake and what those opportunities that the RDA is working so hard on, what they bring to the region, and how we then can actuate those into opportunities for company growth and community growth.
So when you've met your goal, what will that look like? How will the region be different and look different?
So, you know, as we talk about aspirations for the region, one of vibrancy and enthusiasm and hope and collaboration and cooperation, and with it, where we actually feel like the assets are being well utilized and working in tandem and not so siloed. So I think that we're seeing more and more opportunities for municipalities and organizations to work together to bring some of these things to fruition. And it's really a case of many hands making light work and all of us rowing in the same general direction.
So what assets do you think are siloed? You mean like capitalizing on the new additions and the new improvements at like the Gary Chicago International Airport and things of that nature?
Absolutely. To be able to build on the expanded runway at the airport, as I talked about, to be able to take advantage of the enhanced commuter rail times that will be coming from the double tracking in the Westlake corridor, utilizing the Port of Indiana and really attracting companies or helping companies to expand that can use that as an asset and really helping others to understand what that asset is and how we build upon that. Continuing to tout our great economic climate, but also the wonderful quality of life that we have here in Northwest Indiana and the great work that's being done by many other organizations to continue to improve on that and continue to boost that. So it is, I'm very bullish on the future of Northwest Indiana and excited about what we have as assets and what the opportunities are to continue to build upon those. I think that we haven't lived up to our full potential yet, and I think that's going to continue to grow in the coming years.
So now that you've teamed up with TIP Strategies, which is Austin and Seattle-based, you say, based in Austin and Seattle, what is the next step in the process here?
So we had TIP out in March and again in April, and they've been meeting with stakeholders in the region. We'll be circling back. We have TIP back out at the end of May. They'll be here again in June, July, and then we'll roll out the plan in August. So this is a quick, intensive study of the region and then with an action-oriented plan on the back end. So it is truly the goal is to have something that is workable and can make a dramatic impact with some step-by-step opportunities of how we get there and agreement from the business community and the governmental agencies in the area to say, okay, yeah, this is the direction we want to go and this is how we're going to get there.
Anything else you can tell me about any dates coming up in terms of this thing moving forward?
We'll go ahead and there'll be another survey that will be coming down the pipe here in the next month that will get more in depth on what the outcomes were from the first survey, so to dig a little bit deeper into some of the questions. And then we'll be rolling the plan out late summer and then hopefully updating annually to the general public and having an event around where we're at with the plan, what's happened with the plan, here's how we're moving forward. So it's a quick process, but it is a very in-depth one and one that we're living and breathing as we speak. So it's been a lot of fun.
Does the plan have a catchy name?
So we're calling it the Regional Economic Development Plan. Some people are calling it the Red Plan, but Regional Economic Development Plan really gives it a good solid name that it says what we want, what we're trying to do and what we're trying to accomplish, economic development for the 7-county region and how we do it collectively and in a positive manner, all working together.
That's Heather Innes, who's the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson. Well, we know that there have been some problems with our sister station, Lakeshore PBS, and we have an update, we hope, that there will be some good news. It's certainly to let you know how things are standing on the work that is being done by crews to help get Lakeshore PBS back over the air, on the air. And with us in studio, we have Lakeshore Public Media's president and CEO, James Muhammad, and with him as well, we have Matt Franklin, who's the Vice President for Television Operations for Lakeshore PBS. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us on.
Well, for folks, it's been a while since we've talked, I know, and bring us up to date, or first tell us a little bit about the problems, and then bring us up to date with how the resolution of the problems is coming along here. I'll let you kind of start things off.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how to summarize all that. But I believe it was, if I'm getting the date correct, June 16th, we experienced terrible storms that impacted our transmitter, caused significant damage. attempted to engage in some diagnoses and also some possibilities of repair. Because of the age of the transmitter and the extent of the damage, we determined that we actually needed to purchase a new one and seek a loaner transmitter, which did arrive on Thursday of last week in the evening hours. Began work
well, they,
on...
they never show up in the early hours of the day, you know, well, so you have plenty of daylight hours.
Yeah, well, it had to be driven from Quincy, Illinois, and we had to... I possibly snag a driver from lunch to say we need to get this transmitter here. It arrived in the evening, and Matt and the engineer staff was at transmitter site to greet them. Attempted to get it hooked up or in layman's terms, but almost operational on that evening. I discovered more parts were needed, which took a little bit more time. We were hoping to have that up and running on Friday. On Monday, we did discover another problem. We did get the parts for that we knew we needed, and it basically exists in a single cable that has to be made. That's being made as we speak and will be driven by someone who we will probably snag from lunch or a snack or something in an emergency situation. That's how we have to get them. In order to get that here, or the engineers will have to pick that up.
I guess people people don't realize, you know, you're talking about making these connections, and if you go by the tower, you just see the tower, and maybe you see the little building that's at the base of the tower where the transmitter and the other equipment's located, but you've got coaxial cable that has to link up that transmitter and the equipment inside that building to the antenna that's up on top of the tower.
Yeah, it's I don't know, maybe Matt can explain it better.
Yeah,
yeah, when you go into our building, you will see what essentially is a transmitter. But there are wires, cables, computers, and all over the place. I never touch anything when I go in there out of fear, number one, of a shock, and out of fear that I will break something that will cost us money. I'm not an engineer. But our engineers have worked diligently. Matt's been the boots on the ground for that. We're hoping to have the station in our interim plan, which Matt can explain in more detail,
okay, Matt,
up and running today.
Yeah, there's a series of systems that all have to work together at a transmitter site. So mm-hmm. besides needing the high power needs to be able to operate a transmitter of the size that we had, that's one key thing. And so when the storms went through the region on July 16th, that's what knocked us off the air originally. So getting the power fixed was issue number one, and our friends at NIPSCO helped us out there. It was in doing so that I think either through a surge or through a direct damage to the transmitter that we found our issue that we have right now with our aged transmitter. So unfortunately, it wasn't a quick fix. I think everybody in this building wished it was something that we could just replace it with a part. But these systems are very complicated, and it relies on, a series of systems to work together. So Thursday night, Friday, we figured out the communication systems error that was causing us to not be able to broadcast. Now we have a transmission line system that we're trying to replace. Mm-hmm. So as James said, that's getting addressed as we speak. I got off the phone with the engineer that's leading the effort 30 or 40 minutes ago. So we hope to have that back. Once again, this will be operating at a much lower power than our original transmitter. The original transmitter broadcast at a very high level. So we don't expect to be able to have that full service happen until our new transmitter is in place, and that's going to be in the middle of September right now. So this is an unfortunate time for something like this to happen with the auction repack that went through in the past year. Transmitters and transmission systems are in high demand, and that's a backlog. We have a 6 to 8 week. We did order it a week or two ago, but there was 6 to 8 weeks on the delivery date, and that's one of the shortest turnarounds that we had from any manufacturer. Some of the manufacturers had quoted us 14 to 16 weeks,
yep.
And one manufacturer actually said 6 months.
And we should mention that this the repack that you're referring to was something that came about here, some changes that the FCC had made basically to accommodate more TV channels to be turned into more cell tower channels, I guess is the way it is, for phone service primarily, for cellular and the like. And as a result of that, so that's why we see even in the Chicago area, we have had stations go off the air. They've decided to give up their license and go onto cable, but they've given up their over-the-air license to be able to give more spectrum band to give room for this expansion of the wireless and all too. I understand.
Yeah, that's one of the big concerns we have from viewers that are calling us that we're going off the air, right, similar to what some of these stations you're alluding to in the Chicago market. We're not going off the air. Our plan is to make this investment, and it is a costly investment to purchase a new tower. I'm sure James could tell you we didn't plan for that in our budget this year.
Right.
But that's something that we're committed to. And this, once we get the new transmitter in place, that will be something that's going to be robust and it's going to be technologically top of the line. And mm-hmm. it'll be something that we're going to be relying on for the next 15 to 20 years.
That's great. Maybe I should ask, how old is the transmitter that finally got zapped, so to speak?
About 15 years.
15 to 16 yeah. years, yeah. 2002.
So, it was not it's not ancient, because we know some right. transmitters.
This thing runs 24 hours a day.
Yeah, but you say when you talk about even a solid-state transmitter that's relatively new, if you say it's running 24 hours a day, it wears out. Even if it didn't get hit by lightning, it still would probably wear out.
And this is a system that we knew was on the horizon, was nearing its end of life, and that was something we had some talks about addressing in a year or two. Mm-hmm. And hindsight being what it was, it'd be nice to have a temporary or transition one in place. And those are conversations that now we're definitely having, what we can do so that this situation doesn't present itself again.
Well, one of the things I do want to add, in addition to, you know, the critical nature of being on the air, we have the broadcast service and service to satellite networks, but also we're part of the PBS WARN program, which is the Warning Alert and Response Network, which basically means that Lakeshore PBS serves as a provider in cases of emergency situations for direct communication from FEMA through wireless-enabled alerts, and that's basically alerts that would come through on a cell phone, mm-hmm. If they were in need of communicating directly to the public. So we serve as a backup source for that. And so in looking at our infrastructure, we want to, through this program, we got a backup, generator. What we want to, and we'll be approaching local foundations for assistance in the community, is a backup transmitter, because it's we realize the critical nature of the service we provide, but this is also a public safety issue for our larger community. So we're able to get some funds to get the service and a backup generator. But we're going to need community support to really have a solid infrastructure for Northwest Indiana and Greater Chicagoland.
So it shows this is a multi-pronged project here, to say the least. It's not only getting Lakeshore PBS back over the air to viewers who have grown fond of the service and they like the programs and enjoy mm-hmm. the service that they get, and getting that taken care of first. But of course, the importance of being able to plan for emergencies. You can't
exactly.
Do that too. So. James Mohammed is our president and vice and CEO of Lakeshore Public Media, and Matt Franklin is our vice president for TV operations. They've been with us to pass along some good news that folks who have been waiting patiently for Lakeshore PBS over the air, mm-hmm. as well as off their satellite service, will be getting that very soon, that the repairs are being made here, and with any luck, we'll have it before certainly the next few days, it sounds like.
We hope hours. But
maybe hours.
Yeah,
right,
we hope hours. But I do want to, number one, I do want to thank the public for being so patient with us and being supportive, and definitely a million apologies for the inconvenience. I realize what this means for our viewers and for the public, and believe me, our folks are working as hard as they can to restore service, and very proud of the effort and work that they're putting in. And Matt's done a wonderful job connecting with engineers and vendors and coping with me, which is probably the worst thing of it.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for spending time with us to bring us up to date on this, and we appreciate the update as well, too. This is Regionally Speaking. Every once in a while, the Center of Workforce Innovations here in Northwest Indiana puts out a report on the status of the labor market in the region. And let's find out more about the latest report and also some information behind the numbers. We have with us today Robin Minton Holmes, who's the Vice President for Workforce Initiatives with the Center of Workforce Innovations. And with us as well, Allison Bertle. And she is Work One Business Services Manager. Ladies, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having us.
Give us an idea from the latest report how we stand on things like the workforce, about unemployment or employment in general.
Well, the good news is that we are seeing our unemployment rate start to decline, which is really good news. We have been on the unemployment rate reached a high in like 2008 to 2010 because of the recession. But with the most recent numbers, we're actually have a 4.4% unemployment rate. And what that means is that there are more people working, and we're excited about that. There are jobs for people. And there are still some of us that have been left out, left behind, and still need to be employed. But that number has gotten smaller and smaller.
From the information that you get, well, maybe we should start out here by I'll just ask the question, where do you all get the information that you're able to put together for the report?
These numbers are the report numbers actually come from the state of Indiana, Department of Workforce Development, and they're all a formula that's created by the federal government that's been established for a really long time.
In looking at the data, and you've been able to, of course, take a look back at months and even years behind that as well, what kinds of trends do you get to be able to see and tell people about, especially businesses and industry, or prospective businesses and industry for that matter, too, that are interested in Northwest Indiana? What can you tell them about what type of labor force is available for them to be able to take advantage of?
Well, I do think it's important to also note first that the greatest contributor to the decline of our unemployment rate is primary metals in the past month. They've added about 1,000 jobs in the last month. With as it comes to the specifics about business services and what employers are seeing, I'm going to ask Allison to sort of chime in here.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about the largest gain being in primary metals and manufacturing, you've got a lot of different things happening throughout the region. You've got businesses like American Rent-A-Lent who are adding jobs in LaPorte County, adding a new line and producing more jobs available to the county. You've got new businesses that are coming to the region. For example, MCP out of Portage, they're working on getting up and running now. Cameco, another large organization producing manufacturing jobs, going to be up and running by June. So there's a lot of growth that's happening, which is a result of that large gain.
It's always nice to be able to hear good news like that, because we've had so much bad news over the decades, it seems, since the steel industry started going into a slump, not only a production slump, a sales slump as well. And we've unfortunately seen the activities at the mills decline so dramatically. And they've had, of course, retool to make it into the high-tech era to be able to run more efficiently. Are we finding that more of these smaller businesses, like the ones that you've mentioned so far, they're coming into Northwest Indiana or expanding in Northwest Indiana, are taking advantage of the most technological ways to be able to produce a product?
You know, by far and above, Indiana is just a really good place to do business.
Mm-hmm.
And we have demonstrated abilities here in Northwest Indiana to be able to produce the kind of workforce that those individuals need. And we do a lot of that through training and really strong education partners throughout the region. And so that demonstrated effort really gives employers confidence when they come to Northwest Indiana that even if we don't have the workforce they need right this moment, that it is something that can be created. And there's a team of people here in Northwest Indiana that can help make that happen.
Well, I know, yeah, Allison, that's your department, so to speak, working with Work One. What directions do you get to pass along to your colleagues in Indianapolis, the bosses in Indianapolis that are always wondering how the employment situation is doing up here, and what in turn they can pass along to you that will allow you to be able to help get the workforce the place that it should be?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of times when we see unemployment rates declining, that means that we have to shift some strategies that we typically deploy when we're talking about workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And so it means that we are not only working with those who are unemployed, but we're also doing more work with those who are employed and helping them to increase their skills to help them move up into positions as those companies expand. so that as we're working with those lower skilled individuals, it creates opportunities for them to backfill. Here in Northwest Indiana, we have a wide variety of different monetary resources for employers and businesses across the region when it comes to how they go about upskilling that workforce and making that happen. We use credentials so that those skills are very translatable across employers throughout the region and throughout the state. And so using those resources and taking advantage of those is something that it's really important for employers to tap into, especially if they're in some kind of expansion or growth mode.
I think, too, as we thinking about the labor pool that's left that still needs to be employed, and also thinking about how the unemployment rate has declined, it's important that now employers have to look at what are the skills of their existing workers and evaluate, you know, how do I keep these workers so that they don't jump ship for perhaps a job that pays better somewhere else. So that's where Allison and the team are really working with employers across the region to help them get incumbent worker training, which we can help pay for here at the center. And once we work with those incumbent workers, then oftentimes we'll see a slight wage increase for the worker. They move up, which, as Allison was saying, then opens up slots for those who perhaps have been underskilled or unemployed for a while to get back into the workforce with skill development. So the incumbent worker training opportunity that we have is really great. And if employers are interested in learning more about how we can help them get their existing workforce trained so that they can hang on to their good workers, they can get in touch with us here at the center in Allison, and some of the team members can meet with them.
That's Robin Minton Holmes, who is the Vice President for Workforce Initiatives with the Center of Workforce Innovations here in Northwest Indiana. And with her today, Allison Bertle, who is the Work One Business Services Manager. Thank you very much for being with us to give us this good news that things are improving, not only on the employment scene, but improving on how businesses are being able to find the workers that they have. And you're able to do your best to get people trained for the jobs that are being created here in Northwest Indiana. Thanks for spending your time with us today to talk about it.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
The Indiana Agriculture and Natural Resources Interim Study Committee took a field trip on Monday. They visited Purdue University's hemp research site, and they talked to the experts there about the plant itself. And later in the day, at a public meeting, Indiana Hemp Industries Association Executive Director Jessica Scott says the hemp market is continually growing.
$820 million hemp market in 2017. That market is projected to reach $1.9 billion by 2022, and that's the United States hemp market.
Neighboring state Kentucky's invested in the hemp industry a few years ago, and they've been reaping the benefits from that. Warsaw corn and soybean field farmer Dan Zollman is at the meeting, and he says with the tough market, he'd like to be able to diversify and add hemp to his production.
To have an alternative crop to be able to produce to add to the income stream of Indiana farmers is vital at this time.
The Indiana Agriculture and Natural Resources Interim Study Committee will have a report together and turned over to the legislature by October 31st. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.